A few years ago, as a reporter, I found myself walking through a travel conference, and all around me were stands and people trying to grab my attention. But I stopped at one stall out of choice, and I spent the next 15 minutes talking to them about their story. With conferences back after COVID and reporters and content creators also back, how do you get someone who everyone else wants to talk to you? But that's not all in today's Public Relations podcast. As we sift through techniques from across the PR world this week with the wonderful David Barker from Carve Communications. So whether you're riding your mountain bike up a mountain, as I know one listener of the show does, as they told me on LinkedIn last week while listening to the show, or taking a quick break from the office, welcome back to another week of the Public Relations Podcast.
The Public Relations Podcast with Richard Minson.
Well, I hope you're having a good week so far. What a great chat with John Woodruff last week from Two Tone in Amsterdam. He asked me to point out the fact that he doesn't have tattoo parties. It's just the fact that there was a tattooist at some of the parties he organized. And some people have been getting his company's logo actually put on them. It just shows how popular a brand he's made himself into. In fact, it's quite interesting for an independent agency that he's turned himself into a brand, as we were hearing last week. And people are wanting stickers and wanting tattoos as well. He's basically built the PR agency beyond just being an agency where he's helping get press coverage and stuff, but into a lifestyle brand in itself with live music, cycling activities and all that, because he's obviously associated with the cycling scene. I will definitely get John back on again because I think he's got so many good ideas that really kind of turns PR on its head with the way he's approaching it. I also spotted something this week that got me thinking about that story we were discussing with John about pharmaceutical influencers and how important they are now for pharma companies when trying to reach out in an environment where a lot of people have a very negative perception of pharma companies. And I was watching a show this week called The Art of Being Well with Will Cole. He's got 130,000 followers on TikTok. And you can see how much of a target people like him could be for PRs. But it also struck me the importance of getting podcast guests in your influencer pool. You know, guests really help to bring shows to life, and many podcasts rely on them for content and marketing. So people who are doing the podcast circuit, those guests who are influencers in themselves, or could be, not just spokespeople for organizations, could be getting the message out to a lot of different people by doing the podcast circuit, and they are certainly worth reaching out to as well. It's interesting to see how everyone partners more and more with influencers in the B2B space. Obviously, B2C has been done so much, but the B2B space over the next few years, as we were seeing with that survey from Ogilvy as well. But let's move on to this week now, and I am so pleased that we have got David Barker getting on the show this week. Because, first of all, the fact we actually got you in the diary, which is absolutely wonderful, because you're from Carve Communications in Florida, USA, and you've been in this game for a long time. But anyway, enough of what I would say about you. Tell everyone who you are. Tell us a bit about your organization very quickly.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Richard. I'm the CEO and founder of Carve Communications. We are a public relations firm, for lack of a better term. We're headquartered in South Florida, but we are fully remote and have been for the last 3.5 years. We have people based all across the country. We have clients based all around the world. We live at the intersection of innovation and everyday life. That's where our clients live. So heavily into technology, consumer products, as well as enterprise and B2B brands. We've been in business for just over nine years. And as you said, I've been doing this for a while. I've been doing PR now for 25 years. Started out in New York City, and here I am now. We're a 25-person agency and growing. And excited to talk to you. So thank you.
I remember there was a story you were saying about when you sat in, or the first day you did PR, and you were sat in a room around a phone that wasn't connected or something, wasn't it? I'm trying to remember what you said.
I was working at, I'm happy to say, the GCI Group, which I believe is some level of Conan Wolf after all these years. And I was brand new to PR, maybe a few days. I don't even think a few weeks. And they sat myself and the other newbies down in a room, in a conference room, very small conference room. And they said, okay, today we're going to learn how to pitch. And they put a phone in the middle of the table. I don't remember. It might have been connected. And they said, okay, pick up that phone and pretend like you're talking to a reporter. Yeah. And there were maybe 7 or 8 of us, all 21, 22 years old, fresh out of college, having never worked at a job before, having to then act like we knew what we were doing in front of our peers, petrified. And they said, go.
Do you remember what the story was at all?
What's that?
Do you remember what the story was?
I do not.
No, you just remember that moment clearly.
I wish I could. but it was a seminal moment, right? And I still remember it to this day. I have visions of what the room looked like in the brown table.
Yeah.
I was wearing a terrible pair of pants and a shirt, you know, just playing all the money. You know, everything was heavy and wool and, you know, it was, didn't match most likely. But it was a seminal moment in my career because that was really what kicked off my media relations career. Now, 25 years later, having a staff doing all this work and a team doing all of this and teaching them. I tell them that story all the time. I said, look, I could put you in a room with a phone and make you pretend like you're pitching in front of each other, but I won't do that. Go figure out how to do it. But it really taught me a lot very, very early on, amongst other things as well.
There was one other thing. We mustn't get bogged down because we've got to get to the news story. But I was really interested by the fact you said that you've got a completely remote company. How does that work better, in a sense, than office-based ones? Or what do you think of the pros?
The pros for us, and it's been this way since, you know, 3.5 years ago, whenever COVID started, whatever number we're at is, my team, and the team has grown. When we started COVID, I think we were 7 people. Now we're 25. The freedom to live their life outside of work and in combination with work. And I think, look, it depends on every single company, every single agency, every single geographic area where you live, right? Miami, where we started, where we were founded. And back then we were only people that worked in Miami. Commuting is very difficult. There is no public transportation here. So we were all reliant on sitting in our cars to get to work. And that becomes extremely exhausting on a day-to-day basis. And so giving people back that freedom to live their life. Yes, go to the doctor. Sure, go to the doctor. You want to start working at 6 o'clock in the morning instead of 9 o'clock in the morning and you're done by 2? Sure, you have that freedom and making people comfortable. So that's one of the pros. The other pro that's allowed it to happen, and I've been talking a lot about this lately. I've been to a few different PR leadership conferences in the last few weeks. Maybe it's my point of view, but it has allowed our team to create the culture rather than me, the CEO and founder, creating the culture. I feel like when you're in an office environment, that culture is dictated by who's in charge, right?
Yeah.
Lunchtime is noon. Where are you going right now? Who's going to go out to lunch? Hey, we're going to do this in the afternoon. We've created a culture where I've left it to the team to create the culture. I don't know what, especially because we're all remote. I don't know what somebody who's 25 years old living in Cleveland, Ohio.
I've worked in remote companies and for myself as well for more than 10 years now. And I think the main thing when you're working in a remote company is you've got to have the right people. And one of the things about PR is I think it attracts self-starters, people who are excited about the job. I don't think it works if you've got a mundane job where people don't want to be there.
100%. It's got to be something where you, and I tell my team, I've been in every single position they've ever been in PR.
Yeah.
Lying at your desk, angry at your boss, not wanting to show up in the morning, angry at the client, you know, ready to throw your computer on the, I've been in every, frozen.
You know what it's like. Exactly. Yeah. I'd love to do a whole episode on that, but let's get to the main juice of the stuff. Let's start off with a few stories that we spotted this week. Muckrack's recent State of PR Measurement report shows that 66% of PR professionals view measurement as more vital than creativity for proving their worth to clients. The study also reveals they spend over half their time monitoring media, which seems amazing. But interestingly, the number of stories placed still leads as the top metric, while actual brand sentiment trails behind. A notable gap exists between clients and PRs when it comes to revenue impact, with clients seeing it as far more important. What can we take away from this story? I mean, I think some of those results skew themselves a bit because it's just one thing is seen as more of a focus than others. It doesn't mean that other stuff is necessarily less relevant. But what did you make from that?
What I make from that is that we're still measuring the same things we've been measuring for 25 years.
Yep.
And we need to, as an industry, and this is something we're working towards, coming up with a new way to measure the impact of what we do, right?
Yep.
Reach and impressions and unique monthly visitors and number of stories. Those are all great. They don't really tell the full story of what that placement means to the client.
What's going to be needed to change that, though? Because I think one of the problems that I see a lot is that firms and clients still see PR as being just about column inches. They haven't realized how much PR itself has evolved, particularly in the last few years. So how do you get the people who are paying the paychecks to realize that things have changed as well?
We've done it in particular by creating our own unique scoring system that looks at the deeper value of a piece of coverage beyond those typical metrics. And what that has done is now not even with our marketing people that we interact with, from the C-suite level, they're now asking, what is the score of this placement? I need to know what this placement actually means, what it says, what the value of it is. So we talk about, I know we're going to talk about value a little later, overall value, But it's on PR people to find ways to better illustrate the value of the placement other than just it's in this publication, it's got this much reach or this much impression. That doesn't.
So is it just about constantly repeating it to the clients? I mean, how do you find that you can actually get it across to them that you've got to look at this differently? Because what was the other one? It was about, they were saying that percentage of the conversation was more important than actual sentiment within it. Which again, kind of goes back to this idea that all PR is about is getting column inches. It's like, well, surely it's the message. It's the quality of what is being delivered. It's whether it's even achieving a result.
Yeah, that's what we do, right? We continually strive, you know, quantity over quality. Mm. We look less at the quantity. Oh my God, I need 100 placements or I need 200. Mm. I'd rather have 10 or 15 high quality placements and the clients see that value. The rest of the stuff gets filtered out. So that's what we focus on. I think PR people need to focus on is train your clients, teach them, illustrate to them that quality matters more than quantity in this day. Mm. Because the quantity is much, much harder because as we all know, everybody watching, everybody listening, there are just way less PR people and way less media out there than there were 5 months ago, much less 5 years, 15 years ago. So you focus on the quality, keep illustrating to your clients that quality matters more than quantity. But if you're doing PR right, the quantity will come, but you have to focus on the quality.
Let's move on to the next story. It's one you spotted, and this was about UPS, wasn't it? And about the whole sort of industrial relations and the pay they get. Tell us a bit about that one.
Yeah, I mean, the story is that, you know, I think it's now UPS drivers, not their starting pay, but very quickly UPS drivers here in the United States can start earning upwards of $170,000 a year to drive their brown truck around delivering all your Amazon packages or whatever good, you know, whatever you're getting for Christmas this year, or Hanukkah. And so it's that dichotomy of value, right? People are saying, and you see a lot, we've seen a lot in the tech world, tech pros and people working in technology, like, wait a minute, I spent $75,000 on an education and student debt, and I could have just gone and been a UPS driver and making more than I'm making. Yeah. But what it illustrates and what I look, when I look at it is the value of that UPS driver, right? We don't take enough look at that value in the same way looking at the value of a piece of coverage. Mm-hmm. Look at the value of that driver to us. He's not just a guy driving a truck, right? What does that mean to you to make sure that your Lululemon clothes get to you on time, right? Or that Christmas gets to your grandmother on time this year. That's as much the technology that UPS uses. And it's even more that driver getting it there. And that's the value of us needing packages next day. And
it is making sure you're delivering value as well, isn't it? Because like absolutely. With the measurement report where CMOs are saying that they want to see what the dollar return is, that you can't just go out there and have a fun party anymore. Well, I mean, there's obviously some entertainment value, isn't there? If a client enjoys it, there's a value. But in terms of a long-term client relationship, if you're not delivering actual real value, it's not going to work. They're going to give up at some point.
Absolutely. And it's also illustrating, helping your clients illustrate their value. We have four tenets of PR that we practice here at Carbon. One of them is value before features, right? We can all spend so much time talking about our phones, right? My phone has a set of features, as does yours, cameras and pixels and megabytes. But what is the value of this? And I am an Android user. Sorry, everybody. What is the value of this to me compared to somebody else? And it's the same thing when you look at the driver. It's the same thing when you look at coverage, right?
Yeah.
Focus on that value. Those features are important.
It's a really good point.
Illustrate the value for your clients through the media. And then illustrate your value as the PR professional, PR firm to your clients. That is of utmost importance in today's age. Values everything.
One other story, and that's public trust in AI usage by firms. And public suspicion has been highlighted again this week after an article in the Washington Post reported allegations that reviewed USA Today owned website used AI-generated reviews. Unions already involved in a dispute with the owners highlighted that articles were written by people whom they had never heard of or could find on LinkedIn. Now, the owners say the work was carried out by a marketing firm and the content was written by humans, despite the marketing firm themselves saying on their website that it used AI as a core feature of its service. Once again, raises this question of how firms should handle the use of AI when public suspicion remains high. What issues does this raise for PRs? I mean, one of my feelings on this one is that people right now are deeply suspicious of AI. They feel cheated if AI is being used. But I wonder over time if people are going to start getting used to it more. And then from a firm's point of view, I think people are accepting the fact that everyone is using AI to draft stuff, to do the basics, but they still want to feel that they're getting a human that does that final bit, that does that edge. Because otherwise, why bother even, you know, what like with USA Today? Why bother going to USA Today if I can go to ChatGPT and get exactly the same result?
Sure.
It actually comes back to your value point again, I think.
100% it comes back to value. And I think we also have to look at, we're in such early stages of AI. And of course, it's always going to be the scare stories. And we're all trying to figure out how to use it. We actually just got, for the first time, we got asked yesterday in a new business pitch. Somebody we were pitching for new business said, are the reporters you're talking to real or are they AI? And all three of us on the call sat back and were like, we never thought about that before. This is the first time that was asked. So it's something we all have to consider. It's something that we're all trying, and we have to just be conscious about it, right? Be honest about how you're using it.
Yes.
And understand that you will get caught. It's like plagiarism. We once had an employee who plagiarized, and a reporter caught her and called myself and my managing director and said, hey, by the way, this is like 98% plagiarized. I found where it came from. And this was 5-6 years, right? And it's no different of old school plagiarism, right? Copying and pasting from Google or from the encyclopedia, you know, when we were kids doing college papers. To now, how do you use it? Are you honest about it? And there are going to be people that get caught. There's going to be agencies that get caught using it. But the ones that use it properly and the ones that blend and the ones that are willing to blend the tech with the old school elbow grease research time and relationships that make PR are the ones that are going to win.
Yeah, I think about being honest, though, isn't it? Because I think, you know, if you say we are using AI, but only for this part, it's that extra value, again, that the human brings to it. You know, the one other thing you said there, which I've been wondering a lot about, which is with newsrooms. And I feel that in a way that there, and I'd be interested in your thought on it. If there's actually going to be a resurgence of quality paywall journalism, because those are going to be the ones that aren't using AI as much, that use genuine human insight, connections, contacts and stuff like that. Whereas the stuff which is free is just going to be pumped out and no one's going to read it because there's just going to be so much stuff out there. Your thoughts on that?
I think you're absolutely correct. I think we're going to see a resurgence in a short time of real journalism, because I think we've already, I don't remember where I read the story that, you know, those fake journalists and some are already coming back to, hey, and look, it's nice and easy for these pub, you know, for all these media companies to cut costs and use AI. But at some point that's going to come back to bite them because the readership is just not going to be there. People are going to realize it's not real. They're going to want something more substantial, especially in the world we live in right now and everything that's happening right now. So I absolutely believe that's right. We're going to get back to some, it's going to take a little time because everyone's experimenting and see how much cost they can cut and, you know, how they can get away with it.
Yeah.
But it's going to come back around to real journalism.
I think there's going to be a whole new opportunity for that real quality journalism for PR people who are focused on that. Definitely is. And that's going to be all about being in a niche and having the good contacts in there, isn't it?
Absolutely. So. They're still out there. We've got to find them. And we've got to nurture those good journalists.
Well, actually, we're kind of leading into this because now we're moving on to the part of the show where we do our best to break down some kind of news story or PR moment or something that is happening to try and see what kind of techniques we can pull out of them for any sector of PR or comms. Plus, I'll be asking for your perspective as well. Now then, a number of surveys I've been looking at recently show the events industry is expected to return to its pre-COVID levels by 2025 and accelerate from there. That means that events are back, event launches are back, reporters are back, and content creators are back at these events, which leads me to a story of something that happened to me a few years ago, as I was mentioning earlier. As I said in the introduction, I was walking through this travel fair in London as a reporter, and I was covering the event for a radio station. And as usual, I was scoping out the event pretty quickly at the beginning of the day, looking for people I might want to talk to, while moving at speed to try and avoid all the PRs trying to stop me and pitch their story. And as I hurried down this one aisle, I still remember it very clearly, a bit like David talking about when he picked up that phone. I saw this sign, and it simply said in quite large words, but quite crudely, live here, no income tax, corporation tax, 20%. I think there was like a sticker underneath, but it was a plain white sign with these very simple words on it. And immediately my head sort of thought, you know, well, what's that? You know, I want to live like Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg. My fast pace slowed. I turned to the stand and I said to them, what's all this about? And over the next 15 minutes, I learned about the island of Alderney and the Channel Islands between the UK and France and how tax really was that low at the time, by the way. If you're thinking about doing this now, it's too late now. So I found myself trying to find ways then to fit a story around it because I'd spend 15 minutes talking to them. I needed to use that time. So instead of them trying to push a story on me, I was trying to do the work for them now. The thing is here that I've been sidetracked by a simple, small stand that just had a few posters stuck to it, and they hadn't even had to tackle me as I tried to walk past. I stopped myself. And yet, just like David, I have been to events with bright coloured stands, glossy screens, stress balls, pencils, sweets. I mean, I've skied down ski slopes and events sponsored by people, and I've absolutely no idea who they were, and it hasn't stuck in my head compared to that one, which was from a few years ago. So with all kinds of events taking place now, for example, like CES, the technology conference, which I think in last year, wasn't it, had something like 3,000 exhibitors. How do you stand out, especially if you have a limited budget? That's what we're going to talk about today. I mean, my first point from this, I think, David, is that it's about having a clear message. Very few stands that you see at events, can you tell what the heck they're talking about when you first see them? That's my first thought. What are yours?
Yeah, I mean, it is always a question. You walk up to it, what is this, right?
Yeah.
Once, you know, I've been to CES every year for the last 8 years, and there's screens that might show your body scan. There was one a few years ago that looked like this haunted house with zombies, and nobody knew what it was. And it was about, you know, there's some story about they were going to change.
Was that Walking Dead cottage in the woods or something?
And there was another one about reinventing your memories. I don't know if you remember that one. They had these zombie looking people, and there was about memory reinvention or something like that. It goes back to value, as we've been talking about. And I think what really separates and to get the understanding is, what is the activity that you can do that draws you in into that booth, right? Beyond just a phone stanchioned on a thing that you can touch and do.
Yeah.
And that's what we've always tried to do for our clients. We did that a number of years ago, just to tell a quick story with a client in the breastfeeding space for new mothers. And they were a very small company based down here. They were investing in CES, but they said, how do we, a tiny new company, break through the clutter of CES and 150,000 people? And this was before COVID, so probably 8,000 exhibitors before COVID. And so we said, well, let's focus on what your product does and leveraging your product. And so this product helped women extract more milk while breastfeeding. And so we found a local organization in Las Vegas, a breastfeeding organization. We found two women willing to come and pump milk out of their breasts live on the floor of CES for a company called Imlac, if they're out there listening. And we had these women using the product in real life. They were real women using this product in the booth, and they're a tiny little company. And they had a tiny booth and a chair in the middle, the product, and a woman using the product in real life.
I mean, that's an immediate, I can imagine walking past as a journalist, I'm immediately going to wonder what's going on there. And presumably it was fairly clear as well, was it, as to what the story was? Because, you know, you see these stunts, and at times, or you see someone doing something, or you see some kind of art exhibit, and you're looking at it kind of going, okay, what are you trying to tell me?
I do that all the time. And I was just in a bunch of art museums lately. It's okay, it's a black painting on the wall. Right? Why is this hanging on the wall and worth God knows what? Of course, right? We all do that when we walk in there.
We're just not seeing the vision, David. That's the problem.
Yeah. And what it was is, what it is, and I think where everybody has to think about this, is you can do a stunt, you can have a fancy booth, you can spend all the money in the world, but what is the narrative you're telling with that story, with that stunt, with that booth? The way we look at it is, and everybody should, is what, why, how, and it sounds crazy and it sounds stupid simple, but everybody just wants to know, what is it? Why do I care? How is this different from everybody else? And who are you? And if you got some data you can align with that and something you can share with that, either in the booth or afterwards, that's a great narrative to start.
I think it's got to be clear, because again, as a journalist, you're going through these events, you've got one day, you've got all these different, or however many days for the thing, you've got all these different people, and you're going there to get a story, and that story needs those components. And if it's going to take me time to walk past and then walk up to you, then put up with you trying to tell me a whole load of other waffle, I just want to know what the story is. So if that booth tells me what that story is, if it's clear from the start, I'm more likely to walk up to you and more likely to be interested in talking to you. Because ultimately, at that point, I'm just trying to find out the details around the story rather than trying to find out what the pitch was. Because then it can be such a painful process talking to people. And it's just like, just give me the expert, what a swear here, but just give me the story.
It's the why, right? We'll talk about Simon Sinek till we're blue in the face, but that was one of the most honest and true and real things, especially in what we do, is it's not even the what, it's all about the why. Mm. Why this? Especially at CES, there's And even that, when we did this for the imp company Imilac, there were five other companies in the same space at CES, all doing relatively the same thing for that very particular audience of breastfeeding women. And so we had to think about why would the media want to come to us versus another one? Because the other ones just had them on a shelf and maybe they had a nice screen showing the demonstration video. We said the why is because now you can see how this product actually works. Talk to somebody who's actually using it. And that's especially true, obviously, this is CES we're talking about, where there's 150,000 people there and probably 125,000 are men, right? When we're going to CES, like 8-1, 10-1, I think it is, some crazy number. And so we really had to define that why. And it was the why as much as the what we were doing that got people interested. All the media coverage, people from other booths were like, what are they doing over there? Who's their PR firm and how are they getting so much media over there? Come to my booth. And that was their reaction. So focus on that why. Why does that reporter want to come in to see you? Because that the booth is only one part, because then they're going to go home. And it's the same thing that happened with you being a journalist. You then went home and thought about, well, I visited 20 other booths, but I know why I want to write about that.
Exactly.
Versus all the other islands, all the other states, countries, and everything else that was at that travel show. What you did is you thought about the why.
Exactly. Yeah. But they've made the story clear. I think that was it. There was another thought I had on this as well, which is about dinners and parties and stuff like that after the event. And, you know, as a reporter, you get invited to a lot of these and it's like crazy golf and drinks and all this kind of stuff. And I think, again, you've got a problem here because if it's just going for drinks, again, you as a reporter are going to say, well, why should I go to your drinks? What am I going to get from spending that time there? Now, if you can guarantee that I'm going to have a bunch of people I want to connect with, that's fine. But at the same time, if you have 20 other exhibitors at your party, then why am I going to talk about you?
Absolutely.
So again, it's got to be, well, first of all, if you want me to come to your thing, why should I? It can't just be crazy golf because I've done it a bunch of times.
Can't be free drinks. Free drinks every...
And free drinks, absolutely. It's like getting sweets on stands, isn't it?
All the free drinks.
Yeah, exactly. So again, it's got to be clear. What is that value I'm going to get from it? Now, if there is some kind of reveal or some kind of launch that you know I am genuinely going to be interested in, and you're not just going to put all that stuff in your stand already, it is going to give me more information. It's going to give me more case studies. It's going to give me more to write my report. Then yes, I may well be interested, but it's still, you've still got to tell me why. I remember walking out of one event and this PR following me basically and trying to make conversation with me. And she was saying, this was a crazy golf thing. And she was saying, oh, you've got to come along. You know, you've got to come and have drinks. It's going to be so exciting. We're going to have so much fun. And in the end, I just stopped her and said, no, what you should have said is this. Because it's just think like a reporter. Don't just try and browbeat people. Think like a reporter, give them value, and then they'll come.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it goes back to what we talk about value and quantity over quality. We're telling clients now, you don't need to have 500 people at Topgolf. Go have 10 people at a dinner, have the CEO there, invite a reporter or two, have partners there, and make it a conversation.
Yeah.
Make it something valuable. Yes, the reporter's going to get some story, but they're going to feel special and connected. They're going to get that 5 minutes with your CEO or 10 minutes with your CEO when the larger 10 person conversation is done. And that's quantity over, you know, that's quality over quantity. 500 people in the room, you're lucky if you can hear and you're ever going to make it to the bar.
And you're not going to remember where you were.
If you got 10 people sitting around a table with some great food that allows for conversation and the conversation is organized, that quality is going to deliver what you want as a reporter. It's going to give you what you want. As a publicist, PR person, you're going to get what you want. And the brand is going to feel it because it's going to result in that quality piece of coverage and or that relationship that you didn't have before.
I think this stuff also just applies just as much if you're talking about a very small operation as well. You know, even if you're running a small charity in a local community hall, the same stuff applies. If you want to get even influencers, if we're not talking about any journalists coming down, just influencers or local people who are influential in the community, it's about having a clear story again. What is it you're trying to put across and why should they be interested in that? You know, and it's also like you see some really expensive stands at some things, which have, I go back to the Audinary thing again. Yep. It was a really cheap, when I think about it, it was actually a pretty tacky stand. And yet they got my attention over the multi-$1,000 expensive stand that had the glossy seats and all that. So, yeah, I think people think, oh, if I go to an event, I've got to spend a huge amount of money. It's more about having that clear idea.
And it's, you know, Evan at CES is a great example. It was a few years ago. It was the automatic, I think it was the automatic pizza making machine. And then there was another automatic bakery machine. And all they did was bring the machine, put it in a corner of CES, get a 10 by 10 space. And they didn't even need messaging. They didn't need lights. It was the machine, the smell, the fact that everybody loves pizza or wants baked goods or whatever it is. And that drove every single story at CES in 2020 something.
Yeah.
And that's all it was. Make it simple and keep it smart, you know, and you've got interest there. And it's the same with the experiment we did with that breast. It was, let's just show the product being used. That's it. That's what people want.
We were talking from Heather from Juice Consulting a while back, and she was talking about how the work she did with freewater.io and how all they had to do, I'm trying to remember the event they were at. I think it was South by Southwest, actually. And all they had to do was basically hand out free water. The way it worked was it had advertising on the side of the bottle. And that was all they needed to do. They didn't need a hugely expensive stand because that in itself was sending the message. People are going to go, well, why the heck are you giving me a bottle of free water? Job done. You've got their attention.
The simplest things work. It's almost like the conversation about AI can't do that for you, right? You're handing somebody something, telling them the story, presenting them with the why. You know, going back to early in my career, working in New York City, every single day in Union Square, there was some company handing out something.
Yeah.
Because that was the best way to reach somebody, is give it to them one-on-one. That's why you give out trinkets at shows, right? That's why you have people standing there. Or we once invited for one of our clients, we had a Britney Spears impersonator using a karaoke machine, because how else do you get somebody to use a karaoke machine is hit me baby one more time on a karaoke machine with someone that looks like Britney Spears. Simple. It cost us like $250 to hire her for 3 hours, but we had everybody there singing Britney Spears songs at the karaoke machine with all the noise drowning out everybody else. And it was a $250 investment, or some, you know, minimal investment, but it got attention. People understood what it was right off the bat.
Well, we'll talk more about events actually in just a moment, but however you're watching at the moment, whether you're listening on Spotify or on iTunes or however you're normally listening, or if you found the new YouTube versions, which I'm now putting out as a bit of an experiment as well, I would love to know what is the best PR event stunt you have seen. What is it that actually grabbed your interest? So not what looked fluffy or nice or expensive, but what actually you still think about. What was that thing that stuck in your head and you thought, I know that brand, or I have a feeling about that brand? What was it? I would love to know. You can reach out to me, as always, through info@thepublicrelationspodcast.com or via my LinkedIn, which is, you can find me, Richard Midson, MIDSON. Okay, well, we're actually still going to talk about events for a moment, because I always ask my guests to tell us about a campaign that they've been working on recently, hands-on. And you were mentioning the fact about an event campaign you were doing. So this is over to you a bit, David. Tell us a bit about what the campaign was, how you planned it, how you organized it, and what happened.
Sure. The campaign was called Carve X, and it was a media experience for the media. We're very familiar with, and you probably are as well, with the media events that happen at CES, and they have Epcom and Showstoppers, and they happen throughout the year. And there are a number of others where it's just media. Everybody pays $5,000 for an 8x8 table. You put your thing up behind, you put a tablecloth on, and you put your products. That's the typical way of media events, not CES, but these specialized media events. And so we said to ourselves, there's a better way to do this, because everything we do is focused on value, as I've mentioned. How do we do a better job of exposing the media to the value of our clients' products in a one-to-one situation? So we said to ourselves, let's do our own media event. We're going to call it CarveX, the Carve Experience. And so what we did is we rented a space in New York City, roughly an empty space with multiple different rooms. But rather than offering our clients and other companies, how about a 5x5 table? You can come have a representative there and put your product on it. What we did is we looked at our clients' products and the companies that were participating. And we said, what are the value of these? And how are these products actually used? Where are these products actually used by the consumer? So what we did is we took these four different rooms in this space and we created a bedroom for the products and toys that are used by children or adults in a bedroom. We have a client that's in the game space to play games. They're called Relatable, a game called What Do You Mean, which are very popular. So we created a gaming room with chairs and the games set out on the table. We had a playroom. We work with a lot of educational toy companies. And so instead of having the toys on a table, we set up a playroom just like my daughter's playroom looks like out there, with beautiful colors. And we put the products on the floor. on the carpet on the floor and invited the reporters that came. It was about a 3-hour event. We had about 50 people come in through about 3 hours, and the reporters were sitting on the floor playing with the product. You don't see that.
Great photos. That was something I forgot to say earlier. That's the thing with that as well. You instantly got something that influencers, journalists, whoever can take a photo they can use. Yeah.
We had another one of our clients is in kind of the electric scooters for kids business. We had the scooters there, but we invited them to ride around the hallway. And we had reporters getting on the back of these kids' electric scooters, revving them up and driving through the hallways of this multi-office thing. So it was going back to values. We let them experience the product, how it looks in a playroom, how you sit down and play with it, the feel, the touch, organized with other products, illustrating the value benefits of a STEM or STEAM toy or social emotional learning, the games, what that looks like. And so we created this event. We did it in about 2 months. Our timeline was completely insane, but my team pulled it off. And like I said, we built out this space of 4 different rooms within about 4 hours the day before. And we had 50 media come through in about 3 hours on a, don't remember what day of the week, in early August. And the feedback, yes, the coverage work we got and the coverage we're going to get this holiday. And that was the goal, was let's expose some products for holiday coming up. It was August. Everybody's already thinking about holiday stuff for December. So get that exposure. But the feedback we got from reporters who said, I've never seen products exhibited like this before. This is the way I want to interact with products. This was great. I got to feel and touch. And it wasn't, we didn't even have, only one client had a client representative there. Everybody else, the clients were not there. They trusted us as their firm, and they trusted the media were going to interact. We were going to get them the information afterwards, of course. So it wasn't just about some marketing executive saying, here, look at this. It was go, play, touch, do, use, feel. Take a picture of the QR code for more information. And it was amazingly successful. We're already planning on doing it next year, bigger, better, broader, giving us more time to plan for it than 2 months, of course. But it was that, going back to the value proposition, value over features, the what, why, how, and who of the product, and changing the paradigm of these media events to from a table to a...
It's so much more fun as well. That's the thing too, because
to reporters,
those media events can be painful.
And the reporters, some of them stayed for an hour and a half. And most of these things, they're going through table by table by table by table.
Yeah.
They got to feel and touch everything and use it and play with it and try it and experience it. And that's what, and we even saw one of our competitors mimic what we did just short time later. So that's a good thing. It's that experience, changing that paradigm, focusing on value over features. And also the last thing, which we keep talking about throughout this conversation, is quality over quantity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The quality of the experience versus lots of different things, that really rung true with the reporters that were there, and why our clients wanted to get involved and invest in it as well.
I think one of the other things that you bring out there is that with a lot of those meet the media events, is I can just get it online now. I don't need to meet you. But if I'm coming along to take photos or experience something, then, well, I can't do that online. I mean, yeah, you've got VR and AR and all this kind of thing, but there's still... they're a long way away from still being that. I love the idea of the bedroom. Sit down in the bedroom, play with the toys on the floor. It's going to bring up memories inside you of being a child. It just sticks in your head. And then you can always ask for more information afterward.
Yeah, and we can also send product, right? That's still send me a sample, right? Send me a sample. What does that sample do? It sits on your desk underneath the 100 other samples that you've been sent, and we bother you and you say, oh, I'll get to it next week or next month or next quarter.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Now it was, they were more selective as to what they wanted rather than us just saying, yeah, we're going to send you this. Or like the one that I played with in this room, the two that I did over there, those I want, send me those. And they've already reviewed them. Right? We're just sending them for photography or because they want to give it to their kid. They had the experience before we had to send it to them.
You're also given the timely element as well, which is so crucial too, because when people send products, it's like, well, why now? There's no pressing reason to do it. But if this particular event has just happened, you've got a time hook to it as well, which is 100%. Always crucial. Yeah.
100%.
Awesome. Was there anything you particularly learned from that? I mean, there's clearly things there about the way that things have changed in PR, and you were trying a new idea and you're going to try it again now. But were there any other things that really stuck out? Because PR and journalists and society is changing all the time. Was there anything that made you go, oh, that's interesting. Things have changed.
I actually don't think it's things changed. I think that things are still the same. The face-to-face, one-to-one nature, as much as we all think we're going to get away from it, and AI and other technology will take us away from it. And COVID took us away from it, right, for about a year and a half to 2 years. You mentioned at the beginning of this, you know, we're all back. Everybody's back. That's really what stuck with me, is that this face-to-face relationship building nature of PR that I learned 25 years ago with that phone and then being exposed to everything else I did in my first year of PR is still there. It is still the heart of it. And call me sentimental, call me old fashioned. That's fine. Right. Call me old school. My hair is gray. You can't really see it, everybody, but that's what we do. Right. It's not like a car wash where you can go from just putting the quarter in the, you know, from somebody out there washing it, and you can easily transfer to just throwing a coin in the machine, or, you know, coffee, yeah, or, you know, now Chipotle is going to have automated, you know, burrito making machines, as we've seen out in the news. You can automate that, but you can't automate
relationships, human contact. I don't think it's going away anywhere soon.
Especially in what we do, yeah, right? In what PR does. That's what delivers the value.
Yeah. There's no question also that a poor story with a good relationship will always win compared to a good story with no relationship too. Which isn't necessarily always more stories. Always good, but it just gives it that boost. It does make so much difference. Yeah.
And that relationship drives more stories in the future. That's the best
exactly
part.
Yeah. Once you become valuable. You are listening to the Public Relations Podcast with David Burkow from Carve Communications and myself, Richard Midsen, the Public Relations Podcast. You can get the newsletter every week as well. Of course, it's free, thepublicrelationspodcast.com/subscribe. And if you'd like my takeaways from the PR world's best techniques as well, you'll also be able to get that soon via PRology.com too. Right, let's talk AI. And of course, in public relations, understanding your audience is key. Traditionally, comms pros have relied on focus groups as part of the tools that they use to test the waters on new brand messages or campaigns. But let's be honest, focus groups can be hit and miss. That's where artificial intelligence could help. Now, a new report from Microsoft called the rather exciting The Dawn of LLMs, Preliminary Explorations of GPT -4V. Oh, dear. Clearly wasn't written for the press. Talks about the direction ChatGPT's new vision system is going and where it could go in the future. It has the potential to monitor, for example, hundreds of CCTV cameras all at once looking for suspicious activity. But it also has the potential to read the mood of a focus group rather than rely on what people say. So imagine understanding through the body language the truth of what people are thinking. Now, there's obviously ethical questions here. But since people are taking part in the focus group, they should be given their consent anyway, so that shouldn't be a problem. Now, if you want to try it straight away, you're going to struggle with the more open platforms like ChatGPT. I did do a quick test. I tried to upload a group of people from Pexels to see whether it would judge the mood of the group. But GPT says specifically it can't assess emotions of groups right now. But there are platforms that are being developed now, and I am trying to remember. I knew I'd forget this at the beginning of this show. There is a platform I saw the other day that is specifically doing this, which is about assessing focus groups and assessing pictures of people and video of people to judge that mood. So watch out for that. I'm sure it is going to start to develop more. Would you use something like that, David?
Probably not. I'm somewhat of an AI skeptic very early on. We're still going through the learning process here at Carve. In fact, in about a week and a half, we have a whole seminar for my old team to learn more about it. But that seems a little bit far for me to test to use AI to test a focus group just yet.
Going to be interesting to see how it goes though, isn't it?
Yeah, it will be interesting to see where all of this goes, especially that when you're taking human emotion, human response beyond just repeat, you know, spitting out information and data to how am I feeling, how am I doing beyond the realm of security and other things.
I was saying this in the previous show, I uploaded a picture of my cat to ChatGPT and said, how old is my cat? And it said it was 10 years old based on its shape and eye color and all this kind of thing. And my cat is 13, which was quite interesting that it assessed the picture in it. I mean, you know, it might have guessed. It might have got lucky, but it still...
That might work for humans, right? When you don't want to admit your age, your wife doesn't want to admit
your age. Well, you and I are both 21 20, anyway. I mean, we know
wife,
that.
You know, you might be 45, but you don't look a day over 39. Well, he's just confirmed that for me, darling. That's absolutely right.
Okay, so this is a part of the show where we look at questions that have been sent in, mainly via LinkedIn. If you would like to send a thought, then you can check out the newsletter, but you can always reach out to me on LinkedIn at Richard Midson, M-I-D-S-O-N. I know a lot of people don't like to put these questions publicly, so that's fine. If you want to reach out to me that way, that is fine. I will put them in the show, but I won't say who you are or your organization. I would deliberately do that so that we can keep them general so that they can give value to everyone else as well. Let's have a quick look at the question I've got here. Is there a way to judge how often you should post to social media channels of an organization? This is a pretty general question for starters. I mean, over to you, David, first, and then I've got a few thoughts on this as well.
I think you need to, if you're brand new to social media as a brand, I would look at what your competitors are doing and how often they are posting. If you already have experience on social and you're the new social media person coming in, look at what the reaction is and when people are reacting. Too much is always too much, right? You've got to meter it out. So use the knowledge that you have, find the data of what others are doing, and then figure out what works within your calendar and within your schedule. But it's definitely, you don't want to do it every day, four times a day, five days a week. It's best to do it timely. That's our take on it when we make recommendations. And that's not just traditional social media, but even on LinkedIn and other places. Look at what your competitors are doing and then judge from there.
Yeah, it always gets me with, Gary Vaynerchuk, love him or hate him. He's saying that you should put out as much as you physically can. It's like, well, where do you find the time for starters? But he did make a good point that I saw a while back where he said that with the way that algorithms are working now, if you're worried about bombarding people with too much information, you have to remember that the algorithms will only show people as much as they're interested in. So if you are putting out 10 pieces of content a day and someone doesn't care about what you do, they're not going to see it anyway. It's only the people who are going to be actually interested. So there is a degree of actual filtering of that content. But I still think even if people, we get it all the time with newsletters and things like that. If you get too much of it, even of a good thing, it's too much to take on board. So you just give up.
And you have to choose as a brand and as a brand social media manager, are you a noisy brand or are you not a noisy brand? Gary Vaynerchuk made that choice long ago that he was going to be noisy, not in a negative way. He was going to be noisy. But does that speak to your brand premise? Is that the value you want to get out there that you're noisy? Do you want to be noisy? Do you want to be smart? Do you want to be funny? Do you want to be frequent? Do you want to be sometimes? That's what you have. That's what you as a brand manager, marketer, whatever that might be, have to choose first before you do anything.
Next question. I thought this was quite an interesting one, actually. A question from a student studying comms here. How far can we go in spinning a narrative to showcase our client in the best possible light? Is there a set guideline or some sort of criteria to judge the acceptability of how much we can embellish a story?
I love that. Go on, over to you, David, again on this one.
Oh, you're going to throw me that. I thought you might take that one first.
That's fine.
I will do. Actually, my first thought on this one is you have to ask yourself, what actually is spin? Spin and PR kind of got blended together, particularly in the 80s, where I think it went too far. When you couldn't disprove stuff, PR people were coming up with absolutely anything. And I think this is why PR still has this label of being a spinning thing. But if you think about what is information, when someone criticizes your brand, they are spinning. They're just choosing to use the negative points about you. They are selectively giving the things which put you in a bad light. So from a PR's point of view, you are putting across the good things about the company or the things that you're trying to get at, those bits of information. You can't provide everything about an organization. But the other thing as well is that if you are saying something which isn't true, today more than ever, you're going to be found out. So in my view, it is far better to be focusing on that information which is true that helps to portray the brand in the best possible way. And you're doing no different from anyone else, as I say, that's criticizing you. If you think you're being unethical, it's not so much a question of how the audience are going to react to this, but you've got to ask yourself, why are you being unethical? What is the organization doing wrong? What have they got to change? Or what are you spinning too far? I think that's kind of the boundary of where I would go. That's my thoughts.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that helped me formulate my thought. I would say that if you even have to consider whether it's ethical or not, you've already started off in the wrong. And so to this student asking the question, and the way we view it is a narrative should not be a one-time thing. If you're only looking as your narratives as you got one opportunity to tell that narrative, a narrative should be multiple parts. You should be able to not embellish the narrative, but take the narrative and break it down into parts. Yes, there's the message, but then what data supports that message or all five of those different messages? What proof points do you have to share that align to each of those things that allow you to whether it's day one of a campaign or day 50 of a campaign, it's either the first message or you've got four more on the back of that that are going to, it's not embellishing. You are adding on to the narrative that you've already placed. So looking at a narrative as a one-off, one-time opportunity, let's try to juice it up as much as possible. Don't look at it that way, because campaigns and success in PR are not won in a single moment. They are won over time. An old boss once told me, PR is a frequency medium. Lloyd Truckelman, if you're out there listening, PR is a frequency medium. And that you've got to be frequent with your messages. That frequency of delivering a message or a narrative or a piece of a narrative to a reporter is going to drive that interest over time. Sometimes you'll get it first, but most of the time it's going to take two or three messages to hit that, not by embellishing, but by being frequent with that narrative or spreading it out and finding different opportunities to speak to. That's awesome. The way we've.
Perfect. One other question, actually, which it wasn't sent in, but what do you think is the biggest challenge now for PR over the next few years? I mean, we've talked about relationships, we've talked about AI and things like that. What would you say is the biggest thing that the PR industry has got to adapt to in terms of techniques?
I mean, I know we keep talking about AI, but that's probably number one, just because it's everywhere. How are we going to use it? How are we going to overcome those that put a negative light on it, right? We talked about before. And it's just no different than people, you know, embellishing a story and faking it or whatever it used to be, right? Before we had AI. That's number one. I think number two continually comes down to measurement. We talked about that earlier, and not to beat a dead horse, but PR has been challenged to deliver measurement. I've been doing it 25 years, and I'm sure 25 years before I was in it, it was the same problem. And then I think, too, it is talent. It always comes down to talent and people. Are there enough young people willing to learn the traditional ways of PR? And not only the traditional ways of PR, but not everybody can come in as a social media manager wanting to do things on TikTok, and that's important. But finding those people that still, with media changing, finding those folks that still take an interest in the media that's still here, understanding it, willing to do the elbow grease to learn which reporter, not just using Cision or Muckrack, using the media to learn about the media. Are there still young people willing to learn that right at the outset versus wanting to get to point Z by using AI, technology, and other things, and willing to put in relationships? That's, I think, one of the challenges we will continually go through.
What do you think can be done from that? I was speaking to someone that runs an agency in India the other day about this problem of getting people into PR and with the right approach to it. So that, you know, it's a problem that's happening around the world in PR. What do you think it is that needs to happen in where you are?
I think, and when we do it, and I think other agencies need to do it, you can't force them to. You've got to, if somebody's starting, you've got to teach them. You've got to be willing to teach them. Not that they're going to do it forever, but this is the way it's been done. This is the core of it. And then it goes from here. Agencies willing to teach that and willing to do it the right way rather than looking for the quick way out with somebody just to get them trained up and pay them the least common denominator. That's the only way I see it.
So it's training, you think?
Training.
It's inspiring. I think sometimes as well, I think there's not enough inspiration.
Inspiration. And too, you know, we've had a lot of interns come from colleges, and we've hired a number of them. And I always ask our interns who are still in college, still in university, what have you been learning, right? What are you learning while you're there? What are the PR professors teaching you, right? And they say, all we do, no offense to anybody, we spend a lot of time in the AP style book. That's all we do is we learn how to write AP style. I got an AP style book. I didn't learn it in college. The day I graduated and got my job, they handed me an AP style book. I threw it out and I've never looked at it since. And I'm doing this 25 years. So I think it comes down to the universities and the professors and those, you know, where you're learning PR to teach at that level, right? Just like we, when we were young, learned basic history of England or US or whatever. Still learning that today, right? We've got to teach that history of PR and the way it was done and how that transfers into the way it will be done in the future. Because I heard a lot of that. No one was learning. AP style book's great, but there's more to research and reporters and what it means. And how to find one and what a byline is and what the difference is between the managing editor and the senior editor and a reporter and all of the, what a masthead is, right? Where to go into the magazine and find the list of, you know, who the reporters are. I think those still exist, right? Magazines, I'm pretty sure they do. Somewhere they do. In the airport, they do at least.
Yeah.
Those little things help people because Masthead still exists on websites, right? Find the about page, who's what, you know, use those things. That's really, really important.
I think the biggest problem I see still is story. And this has been a problem for decades, is that people still just... I was interested. I was talking to a friend that runs a course on journalism in London. And she said that now they're doing... This is for journalism course. And they're now doing 4 hours of storytelling practice a week because they know how important that is now. Everyone can do the technical stuff. There's spell checkers, grammar checkers, and all stuff like that. But what the human element still is being able to tell a story that will captivate. And that's why they're going so hard on it now. And sometimes I think that one of the problems with PR people, new PR people, is that they're just thinking about that technical stuff like that. It's got to be story. You can learn the rest. You've got to get the story first if you want to get the attention.
Absolutely. And it's beyond the press release. You see a lot of kids in college coming out learning how to structurally write a press release, which is important. Yeah. But it comes back to the first thing you asked me or the story you asked me to tell about the telephone. That's storytelling. Yeah. How do you tell a story? What is the value of that story? And a lot of young people these days, unfortunately, and I have a 12-year-old son, they don't know how to story tell. They only know how to go like that. And that's a big difference, right? My son doesn't even know how to talk, use a Foley. Like he only talks like this, again, all the like that. That's story, right? But it's really, really important is storytelling. And learning storytelling, yes, from PR, but from film and TV and movies and how these things are structured. I did that in college. I went from taking business classes to film classes about, you know, fabulous cinema and the storytelling that was involved in the fabulous cinema or the storytelling. I must have watched Blade Runner in 4 different classes, 4 different times during my junior, senior year of college. But the storytelling that was involved in Blade Runner and the multi-layered
teaches you how to construct a story.
Teaches you how to structure a story. Yeah. And that was just Blade Runner. You can use any movie, you know, you can use Goodfellas, Godfather, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. But you're absolutely right. It is about, because that's what today is in our world of PR with the limited resources that are out there and the limited media. It's storytelling. It's value, it's quality, and it's relationship in order to do that.
Yeah. Well, we went on a bit longer there in the community bag, but hopefully you found that interesting as well. If you would like to send in the questions, as I say, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn, Richard Midson, MIDSON. Let me thank David from Carve Communications. Honestly, I think this show could probably go on for 5-6 hours, but we probably better round it up. Thank you so much. I mean, to sum up, I think you kind of just did there on the whole thing about the value. I mean, is there any sort of lasting thought that you think people should be thinking about in the PR world?
Just don't forget about the relationships. Relationships are everything, but they need to be supported by the story and by the value. Because the old adage is, you know, it's not who you know, it's how you're telling the story, and you're never going to get a favor just based on the relationship. You still have to tell that story. Stick with that and you'll be successful.
Awesome. David, have you got any particular campaigns coming up that you're really excited about you'd like to share?
We'll be at CES in January with about 5, 6, 7 clients. So if anybody out there will also be at CES, look me up, find me on the site. My email is listed at the bottom there. Would love to meet and chat with people. I love talking PR, as you can tell, but we're all trying to get through the holiday season and get to CES. That's for sure.
You better say it aloud because not everyone's going to be watching this. Most people will listen to the show. So say your email address and how to contact you.
Absolutely. We're at carvecomms.com, CARVECOMMS.com. And my email is david@carvecomms.com. And you can always find me on LinkedIn. That's the best place. A lot of good content there on LinkedIn. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, David. So if you are running a campaign, let me know what you are up to and a little bit about it so that I can give you a plug on the show. You can reach out to me, as I say, on LinkedIn or on PRology.com coming very soon as well. If you would like to be a guest host on the show and want to introduce yourself to everyone, then head to thepublicrelationspodcast.com. You will see a link at the top there which says the word guest. Pretty obvious. You click on that, it's got all the details about how you can get involved in the show, and I would love to get you on if you can tell lots of stories like David was just doing now about things that you've been hands-on with in the PR world that you think other people can benefit from as well. I would love to get you on so you can show off your personality and your skills to everyone else too. That's it for this week. I hope you are having an absolutely fantastic week, whatever you're up to, whether you are riding a mountain bike up a mountain at the moment or however you're listening to the show. I hope you have a fantastic rest of the week, and actually no show next week. There's not going to be one. I've got to go to Europe for a conference, so I'm not going to be able to do one next week, but I will be back after that. But in the meantime, have a fantastic week. and I will speak to you real soon.